I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls. Has barricaded the world with hate. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness. Without these qualities, life will be violent. And all will be lost. Do not despair. The hate of men will pass. And dictators die. Dictators die. And the power they took from the people will return to the people. Will return to the people. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world.
Nation. Oh, this is Clint, your host. Hey, great guest today. I'm really excited to have Mr. Ted Weiland on today. He is the author of this incredible book, Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, The Christian Perspective. Website, actually, if you want to check it out before you buy it, which I'm going to have to give a high recommend to this one, Bible versus, spelled out, BibleVersusConstitution.org. Go to the link there at the top that says Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. You can read all about it. First of all, let me say, Ted, that I commend you, not for just the work you've done, but because I was going to go down this path for my own research purposes, and I know it would have taken me probably way more time than I would have liked to put into it. You have made a concise and wonderful attempt here, and I would say successful, to once and for all prove without any shadow of a doubt, in my opinion, just after reading this, that we are, well, first of all, that the notion of a Christian nation is sort of a false notion. We call nations across the world Christian nations, but that, of course, is a legal status, and so it is Christian by name only, which really means absolutely nothing. The true Christians are always, of course, thrown to the lions. Those who don't accept and don't wish to be part of the Gentile nations. So, with that said, I'd like to welcome Ted Weiland, to the show, and this is going to be a good one, folks. Welcome, Ted.
Hey, Glenn, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share with your guest and with you on this show.
Well, I'll tell you, like I said, I've been writing a three-part series on the Constitution, and actually the Masonic founding of this nation as opposed to the quote-unquote Christian founding, and so I was very pleased.
Clint, are you still there? I can't hear you.
Sorry. I think I had a little mic shortage there.
Yeah,
I was very pleased to find this because I was writing a three-part essay on the origins of the United States, the true origins, which turn out to be quite Masonic and quite different than the history books tell us. And this was sort of my final hurrah into, okay, folks, look, there's a couple things we have to know. One of those, and the most important thing, is that there is no such thing, literally, as a Christian nation, because all nations are under the law of nations, first of all. Secondly, that the United States, in and of itself, is in no way, shape, or form what you could call a Christian nation. Now, on this show, we have gone over all of the tools that the Bible warns us about. We have talked about surety. We have talked about the bond that creates, that you'll smart for being a surety. We've talked about not respecting persons, not respecting flattering titles. That includes attorneys and presidents and kings and queens. We've talked about just about every possible tool and every possible status that we can become, which is against the Bible. And unfortunately, that is exactly what this nation is all about, is taking us from the natural realm and putting us into the physically artificial realm, if you will. What Ted has done is to make a backbone of that, to show the other side of this, to show that there is no possible way that you can say that we are, one, a nation of Christians, and two, unfortunately, Ted, I don't know if you agree with me on this particular point, that in no way can a citizen of the United States, in surety and in personhood, actually claim to be a quote-unquote true Christian, because which really would technically mean that there are no Christians, because we've all been sucked into the artificial realm of legal versus the Bible, and that's a very very scary thought when you think about it. The fact that there can be no Christians because we've all been usurped into this artifice, believing that we're doing the right thing, believing that we are being part of a Christian nation, while at the same time doing everything that is solely and utterly against the Bible's teaching. What say you, sir?
Well, when it, you know, obviously we're talking principally here about Bible law versus the United States Constitution, which is not only the title of our webpage, our website, but also the title of the website comes from a book, a 565-page book called Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, The Christian Perspective, in which we examine every article and every amendment by the Bible. And whereas Christianity has so desperately, I think, wanted that document and those men to be our guys and our document, when you actually examine it by the standard, I'll talk about what that is here momentarily, and probably most of your audience already recognizes what it is. But when it's actually examined by the standard, Clint, it's found to be anything but a Christian or biblical document. It's biblically, it's antithetical. There is hardly an article or an amendment that's not antithetical, if not even, and in some cases is, seditious to our God, the one known as Yahweh in the Bible, to his morality and even his sovereignty. And actually, the book came from a 30-part audio series I was actually challenged to do, and that turned into an even more expanded form in the form of the book. And I might mention here from the onset that for your listeners, and we might want to do this a couple times through as you'll probably gain listeners as the evening goes on, but if they'll go to the website, again, it's Bible Law versus spelled out, V-E-R-S-U-S, Constitution, BibleVersusConstitution.org. If they'll go to the right-hand sidebar, they'll find, I think, the third entry down is our 10-question Constitution survey, or at least the link to that. And if they'll take that 10-question survey about the Constitution as it relates to the Bible, we will actually send them a free copy, a complimentary copy of the 85-page primer of Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. Realize that a 565-page book is daunting for most people in this day and age, and that we needed something a little bit smaller. So we've condensed it down to 85 pages of some of the most important information, and that's will be free to anyone who will take the Constitution survey, and we'll be pleased to send that to them. We'll send them some CDs and some different other material as well that they can peruse and go through, and hopefully it'll make a difference in their lives, because once you dig into this from a Bible perspective, once again, as desperately as Christians want it to be our document, it simply is not. And as you pointed out, it certainly has Masonic and Enlightenment roots. In fact, it's that to its very core. I'm sure you're probably, and probably some of your audience are familiar with Chris Pinto's work on the Masonic aspect as well, and he's done a great job regarding that.
Yes, absolutely. So let's start out. You know, I don't know where to start with you, honestly, but I think we should start out from sort of the beginning when people were coming over here in the beginning, before there was the United States.
Can I start? If you allow me, I mentioned the standard. Can I mention the standard first, just so we have
Sure.
What I consider the biblical foundation to where we're going tonight.
Absolutely.
And this is really the foundation of why I ended up examining the Constitution by the Bible, and that is because I am what is known today as pronomian versus the majority of Christianity, which is antinomian. Your audience may not be familiar with those terms, or at least some of them may not be. The word nomia in the or nomos in the Greek is the Greek word that is most often translated law in the New Testament. So pronomian is one who believes that the law is still applicable, not for justification. Justification is only in and through and by the blood of Christ and his resurrection from the grave. But that the law is still, pronomian is one who believes the law is still applicable under the New Covenant, as it pertains to our life, how we should live our lives as individuals, as families, as a society, and even as government, versus the majority today who have been bamboozled into believing that the law is no longer relevant, which means God's morality is no longer relevant, which means that God is no longer relevant, into believing that the law is not relative today, that it has no bearing. So Bible law versus the Constitution comes from the perspective that God's law, his morality, and therefore he himself are relevant, is the basis of where this comes from. I really could care less about the Constitution other than it provides the medium, the paradigm by which to reveal how superior God's moral laws are compared to what we find even under the Constitution, even under what most people consider man's best. But my question is, why would we want man's best when we can have God's perfection?
It's a really good question, actually, especially when you start understanding what that is. To be clear now, what we're talking about is the typical corporate, if you will, Christian, by saying antinomian, which basically professes that because I have taken an oath to a church or I've taken a vow to a church instead of God, I've accepted God, I've accepted Jesus, I'm free. I can sin and be forgiven by the church. I don't have to follow the law anymore because I've already, I'm already basically assured to go to heaven. There's nothing I need to do anymore. I don't need to know the law. I don't really need to read the Bible because I've been saved. That, to me, is the perfect epitome of the antinomian aspect, where you're freed from the moral law on earth because you seem to believe that you're guaranteed a place in heaven after this life, which is, if you think about it, one of the strangest notions and probably one of the best reasons to understand why the church has done such evil things in the name of the Bible. Of course, that's in name only. I hear the music, Ted, so we're going to go to a commercial break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned, folks. All right, folks, we are back. Well, we're speaking to Ted Weiland today, author of Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, a website. Again, is Bible versus Constitution, all spelled out, .org. Ted, I got to tell you, man, you sent me this. You sent me the primer book, and I very much appreciate that. Always a joy to get stuff in the mail, especially when it's the size of this book. Now, the primer you were talking about sending people for taking the survey online there, that's what what Ted sent me. And I got to tell you, you wrote one thing in this book, just one little four-word sentence, basically, that I thought was the most profound thing in the whole book, the most profound thing that you've actually said in this whole book. And it's such a simple concept, and yet to try to describe it is so very difficult. You said on page 37, you said, Christendom became merely Christianity. Let me say that again. Christendom became merely Christianity. Now, when I read that, I knew exactly what you were saying when you said that. Why do I know that? Well, because I know the legal language. I know how to understand the difference between those two words. When we add the word It terminates a it literally means a jurisdiction. It means basically doom or judgment, kingdom, earldom, freedom, wisdom, all of those different things. Now, when you say the word Christendom, that literally would mean that the quote-unquote kingdom that you live in would be the jurisdiction of Christ or of the Bible itself, God's law. And that is, like I said, Christendom became merely Christianity. When I read that, where the actual lifestyle became mere religion or mere belief, I totally identified with that. It's become what the Bible, I believe, said were empty listeners or forgetful hearers or something like that.
Well, let me add to that. Just kind of a thought that came to me. Christendom, D-O-M, merely became Christianity. And another term for Christianity is Christendom, D-U-M-B. So Christendom was turned into Christendom, if you will, D-O-M versus D-U-M-B. And I really believe that where we're at today, Clint, is best described by Christ in Matthew 5:13. As salt that's lost its savor, good for nothing but to be trampled under the foot of man. And the reason for that, or one of the principal reasons for that, is, again, that they have rejected the means by which we take dominion on his behalf. And that can only be accomplished through law. Any kingdom, regardless what it is based upon someone's law. Well, if we're going to pursue Yahweh's kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven, Christ's kingdom, it's based upon law. It's based upon, in this case, the moral laws of our God and Savior versus the immoral edicts of man. What man has created, including the Constitution, doesn't even qualify for law. Isaiah 33:22 says that Yahweh is our judge, king, and lawgiver. James chapter 2 and verse 12 says that he's the only lawgiver. And so if only his law, if he's the only legislator, the only lawgiver, then only his determination of what is good and what is evil constitutes law. Anything contrary to that is lawlessness or immorality. And I'd finished off my last statement by saying why, even if the Constitution is the best thing that man has ever come up with, why would we want man's best, even if it's that, when we can have God's perfection, as described in Psalms 19, verses 7 through 11, the first part of which says, the law, reinserting the name that God inspired to be there, rather than the Lord, it should be Yahweh, the law of Yahweh is perfect, converting the soul. A lot of people say, well, we need to be about the business of converting souls. Well, of course we do where we can and as often as we can. But one of the principal ways we can do so is by returning to God's morality as found in his laws for at all levels of society. And then the rest of the world is going to look at this country once again like they did in the 1600s and say, what is it about these people? And what is it about their God that blesses them so mightily for what they do? It's what's described in Deuteronomy chapter 4, 5 through 8. So that's the basis of where this is all coming from. I don't want man's best. That's autonomy. That's humanism. Humanism is just a contemporary form of Baalism, which is another subject here. But I want God's perfection if it's available, and it is available still to us today. And as far as those, you wanted to get to the 1600s and the Puritans, and this will kind of maybe get us over there too. So many people think, well, you're trying to be justified by the law. No, we're not justified. We're not under the law as they were under the old covenant. Our righteousness does not depend upon keeping the law. It depends upon our faith and surrendering ourselves to Christ as Lord and Savior.
Well, this is what people
don't. If I could just add this one thought here, if I got time.
Sure.
Puritan minister Samuel Bolton, 1606 to 1654, wrote the following. I think this best explains it. It says, the law sends us to the gospel for our justification. The gospel sends us to the law to frame our way of life.
Well, I'll tell you, another thing that rang very, very true, and you know, you can't really argue that some of the points you've made are self-evident. You say in here that there is no such thing as unalienable rights, that there are only God-ordained responsibilities. Now, if you think about what that actually means, and I've tried to get people to really focus on this notion that the concept of unalienable rights don't exist. There is no such thing. And what because of course a right is a concept of man, but more importantly, you know, it's tough to put this into words, but the reason that people don't want to turn to actual the concept of what you're talking about is because it literally means that you have to try to be or to become as godlike as you can. That means taking responsibility for everything you do, whereas in our current system of government, you have no responsibility for your actions. You've got insurance on your surname. You've got everything you could possibly want to not be responsible. I looked up the words because I'm so fascinated by the meanings of the names that are used in the Bible. And the word Jesus, of course, refers to the word Yeshua or Joshua. And when we look up Joshua or Yeshua, it means Yahweh is salvation. So the meaning of the name, behind the name Joshua, is Yahweh is salvation. So, okay, what happens when we look up Yahweh as a name, the name of the quote-unquote Hebrew God? Well, it literally means to be or to become. So if Jesus, the belief in Jesus means Yahweh is salvation, and Yahweh means to be or to become, you see, it's a closed loop. This is not just about believing in something. This is about walking the walk, not just talking the talk. To be or to become God-like, that is what it means. And when I say that, I mean follow the laws that are presented to you. Now, when we get back from break, Ted, I want you to explain something to me because I honestly don't know the answer and haven't had time to research it. What is this perfect law and how is it justified as being perfect? When we get back, we'll go into that. Stay tuned, folks. We are back. We're with Ted Weiland today. Now, Ted, there's so many times in the Bible, I'm just astounded by it, actually, where it tells you, you know, that you must walk in the law. You must, you know, so shall I keep thy law continually forever, ever, and I will walk at liberty, according to Psalm 119 and James 125. But whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed for his deed. Psalm 19:7 says the law of Yahweh is perfect, converting the soul, like you said. Explain to me, what is the law of Yahweh and why is it perfect?
Well, first of all, it's perfect because it comes from a perfect God who has perfect righteousness, and it's the embodiment or the reflection of his righteous nature, his morality. The law itself obviously did not come into existence. There was no need for God to have a law without man and his need for its boundaries upon his life. So the law itself came into existence, and we're talking about the law that reflects the morality of our God, came into existence with Adam and Eve's transgression, their violation of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which, by the way, was the law itself. They were violating the law the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Where do we find the knowledge of good and evil but in God's moral laws? However, before that point in time, God didn't need laws. He was the reflection. He was the embodiment of his very morality. And when people want to do away with God's laws, they need to, once again, as I pointed out a little bit ago, they need to understand that if you do away with God's laws, you're doing away with not only his morality, but his very righteous nature, and therefore you do away with, you essentially, for all practical purposes, of course it doesn't ever happen, but you do away with God. Most of Christianity are sadly, tragically convinced, and I was in this frame of mind myself at one time, that the law did not even come into existence until Moses came down Mount Sinai with the two tablets containing the Ten Commandments. But in fact, that is not the case. If people would go to Genesis 26 and verse 5, for example, back to the time of Abraham, it says, because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So we see even at the as far back as Abraham that he was keeping the laws. Now, he did not keep them for the same reason they did under the Mosaic Covenant. The Mosaic Covenant was, as Paul describes it in Galatians chapter 3, and verse, I think it's verse 19, was the added covenant that came 430 years after the promises given to Abraham. And with that Mosaic, we're also told there by Paul in Galatians 3 that it was added because of our transgressions. In other words, because Abraham and those at that time were not willing to, were not willingly keeping his laws out of love for God and love for his fellow man, God said, well, I'm going to put you in bondage to it then. And that was the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant, so that they didn't stray so far away that they were lost completely, and that it, in its bondage, would become the springboard for Christ and the salvation we have in him. That's what it means to be under law rather than under grace. The Abrahamic covenant, actually, in the way they were in, it was intended for them to keep the law out of love for God and out of love for their fellow man, is the same, is essentially one and the same as the Christian covenant. The Christian covenant, through Christ, through his death, burial, and resurrection, is a return to what God had in mind during the Abrahamic covenant, but they failed. And now, thankfully, through God's redemption in Christ and the empowerment of his Spirit, Romans chapter 8, we're able now to keep that law. Not perfectly, but certainly to a much greater extent than they were without the Holy Spirit to guide and direct them. And so what we're talking about, when we're talking about the perfect law of liberty, we're not talking about the Mosaic Covenant and its requirement to keep the law in order to be justified, and the Levitical sacrifices, because they couldn't do it, they had to have the sacrifices. Christ is the fulfillment of that. He's our justification. He's the one and only sacrifice we need, and therefore we're only talking about the moral laws of God, his commandments, statutes, and judgments that should be applied in the way we walk and live our lives, on an individual basis, on a familial basis, and a societal basis, including government. We need to return to that. If we want to save ourselves from the precipice, America, from the precipice of moral depravity and destruction, we've got to return to God's perfect laws, because the Constitution, even in its original intent, is the reason we find ourselves on the cliff or already fallen over the edge.
Well, now that's tough for some people to swallow. A lot of people don't have the capacity to, I believe anyway, to ever come to the point where you are. What about the rest of the folks out there who, okay, you just said a mouthful, but you didn't actually answer my question. Why is God's law perfect? What is God's law? People need to understand that when we say this, we're not just talking as a religious, sort of zealot, that we're saying, no, there are very, very specific things that makes you, if you will, quote-unquote Christian, And it's not, again, just the belief system that you just put across, but it is, in fact, living according to a certain set of natural laws, do no harm, et cetera, et cetera. So that, my question is more, if you will, of a temporal nature. How do we walk the walk? What is that law we're supposed to follow? Is there a list somewhere? Is there some is there some very, very specific thing we can look at to say, okay, this is the perfect law? See, that's the problem, I think, is that you can't just take a quote here and a quote there. You have to have something tangible for people because of the state of being that we are in today.
There is a list. It's called the Ten Commandments. Now, what most people think of as the Ten Commandments is only in its most limited form.
Sure.
But the commandments, now the commandments are a reflection of the Creator's and therefore Sovereign's moral, righteous, his very being. But the commandments, as we normally think of them, the Ten Commandments, are never understood completely until you also add to them their individual statutes which explain those commandments and the judgments which enforce them. And so to say just the Ten Commandments, although when the Bible speaks of the Ten Commandments, it automatically includes the statutes and the judgments, when we say it today, we hang the Ten Commandments on our church buildings, or if the church even does that anymore. But it entails much more than just those Ten Commandments as we normally think of them. Let me see if I can't come up. Well, let me share it this way. Any law, even quote unquote law, man's law, if you will, has three integral parts: the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments. For example, man has traffic laws. One of the traffic laws is the commandment that says, "Thou shalt not speed." Now, we take it for granted today what speeding is in any particular situation because we've grown up and we have lived in the system enough to know that "Thou shalt not speed" means a number of different things in different situations. But without the statutes that explain the commandment, "Thou shalt not speed," for example, 20 miles an hour, anything over 20 miles an hour in a school zone, or 15 miles an hour in the city, or 65 on the highway, or whatever it happens to be. Without those statutes that explain the commandment is basically never going to be understood in its fullest extent. And for those who are not willfully going to keep that commandment, there must be judgments that then enforce those who would otherwise violate it. And so every law is made up of three integral parts. Thus, we do have exactly what we need in understanding what the perfect law is, found in the commandments, when we add to them their statutes and judgments which enforce them. For example,
we're going to go to a break here. So what you're basically saying is that we must do due diligence and actually read and learn the darn things, and that's what a lot of people don't want to do because that entails responsibility. We'll be back, folks. Stay tuned. Let me tell you, folks.
You can grow ideas.
Let me tell you why I have a problem with government, with the artificial legal realm. And this should really hit it home for people, because when the government despises anything that is natural, it hates the natural law, it hates the laws of nature, it hates God's law, it hates responsibility, personal responsibility, it hates all of that stuff, because that's stuff that can happen outside of its control. Now, one of my favorite examples of how to explain why government has nothing to do with, well, God or Christianity, is its definition of, well, act of God. You see, this is one of the few times where the legal dictionaries will actually refer to God as a supreme entity, as the everything, as nature itself. God, or the act of God, this is how it defines it, folks. Have you ever thought about this? An act of God is an inevitable accident. Any misadventure or casualty is said to be caused by an act of God when it happens by the direct, immediate, and exclusive operations of the forces of nature, uncontrolled or uninfluenced by the power of man, and without human intervention, and is of such character that could not have been prevented or escaped. Oh my God, nature is, God is so horrible, because all that comes from God, you see, is misadventure and casualty. It goes on, it says, well, what is an act of God? Well, it's an inevitable accident or casualty, any accident produced by any physical cause which is irresistible, such as lightning, tempests, perils of the seas, inundation or earthquake, and also the sudden illness or death of persons. God forbid that government actually acknowledge that its doctors and its pharmaceuticals are the number one killer of humankind, and there's nothing natural about it. Under the term act of God are comprehended all misfortunes and accidents arising from inevitable necessity which human prudence could not foresee or prevent. Now you tell me, Ted, does that sound a bit arrogant for for the law of man to suggest that that it should have power over God to prevent God's blundering idiocracy that he has created called nature? I mean, it just, you know, when you think of it this way, it really makes you understand why you should not put your faith in this person we call government. You should not respect these flattering titles such as bar attorney who creates these legal terms. It's really, really self-evident when you read a definition like this out of Black's Law First that government has no respect of nature. It tries to do everything to control nature. And I'll add one more thing to that. When it calls us natural, when it calls a man a life that is born in nature under God in the natural realm, when it calls us a natural, it is saying that we are illegitimate. It is saying that we're born out of its legal wedlock. We are a product of God instead of a production of government. That is what the word natural means to government. You see, it does everything it possibly can to control the realm of God and nature. And that brings us back to the law of God, or God's law, the laws of nature, however you want to say it. This is kind of what we're, this is kind of what I'm getting at, Ted, is really what the law of God is to stay the heck away from this type of thought, this legal fiction that government is created. Do no harm to others or their property. With every right comes a responsibility. With every responsibility is a duty. You know, these a duty to not harm others, just as you would not be harmed by others. This is the conscious thought process that must be taken, that must be contemplated at all times for the quote-unquote Christian. It's not something you read and then forget about. No, you must act under this quote-unquote perfect law. And really, when we say it's the perfect law, it's because if you act under this notion of do no harm, it means you can never be forced into a situation where the legal law will have any control over nature or over you. That's amazing.
Well, you know, there is no escaping God. There is no escaping, and when I say that, there is always a God. It's either you recognize your creator, who the Bible describes or identifies as Yahweh, the I am that I am, the ever living one, the one who is the beginning of everything and therefore sovereign over all. Or if you reject that God, then it's not that there is no God, you simply have taken his place. You've usurped the position. And therefore, since God is inescapable, or the idea of God, the idea of deity, then there is no escaping theocracy. one's laws determines who his God is. And when you understand that, then it comes down to what the Bible describes over and over and over again. In fact, it's the middle verse of the entire Bible, Psalms 118, verses 8 and 9. It comes down to the battle of me versus God, or in the collective sense of we the people versus God. Or, excuse me, we the people versus Yahweh, one God versus another God. It's what Judges chapter 21-25 describes as every man, whether individually, collectively, or by representation, doing that which is right in his own eyes versus doing that which God requires of him. It's a choice between the document that begins in the beginning God, or the one that begins we the people. And that's really a summation of what the book Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, A Christian Perspective, is really all about. It's examining or contrasting the two gods, the two standards of law, of morality and immorality, and the basis of why you'd even do so. And so it really comes down. Some people, I mean, they're just not going to have anything to do with our God because they prefer to be God themselves.
Well, and that's the trick, isn't it? When we go back to the Ten Commandments, we then have to define what those specific short little terms actually mean. To have no other gods before means to have no other law than the law set out by God. So when we're talking about turning our backs on God and going under the legal law, or any law for that matter, that is not, of course, I mean, again, to abandon the biblical law for another law system is to change gods, literally.
That's right.
and that's what the word magistrate means, is God. So presidents, kings, etc. What it really means, though, when you say that God never leaves us, he's always by our side, it is our choice, though, to be manifest in God. In other words, it is our choice to manifest his law. And when we don't, we lose, most importantly, we lose the protections of that higher or highest law. We enter into a system of a different God, and therefore we are under those laws through our voluntary discourse within that law. So the most important aspect there is that, yeah, God's always going to stand by your side, but whether or not you play by his rules depends, is what makes his law give you protection. And that's a hard concept to get into people's heads. It's not the belief, it's acting within that system of law, it's acting within that God. That's the trick. And you have to understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that every possible government out there is a religion, and every religion is a government. So you have to be very aware that they're all designed to take you away from what we're talking about, correct?
That's correct.
All right. When we get back, we go more into this Constitution thing, because what you've written in this book, just the primer that I have, is absolutely astonishing with just the simplicity of the statements you've made. Blows my mind. We'll be back, folks. Stay tuned.